I'm Susan Lube here on Women's Focus, and today I'm talking to Charlotte Bunch. And we've heard from you before on Women's Focus, but usually it's around International Women's Day. This time we're talking to Charlotte Bunch because she's going to be in Albuquerque. Welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Welcome to Women's Focus. You're going to be in Albuquerque because of a special film that's going to be shown here about your life, called Passionate Politics, The Life and Work of Charlotte Bunch. And we really need to start off and say that one of the interesting things to us here in New Mexico is that Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, well, I grew up after the first 6 weeks of my life in Artesia, New Mexico, in the southeastern corner, as your listeners probably know, which is a fairly conservative corner of New Mexico that they used to call Little West Texas, a small town. And I lived there all my childhood until I went away to college at age 17. So very much a part of my upbringing. And I think there were both, you know, wonderful things about that and difficult things. It was a small town, and it was a place where my parents were small-town professionals. My father was the family doctor in town. And so we mingled and with really everybody. And as I later learned in life, I think it taught me something about having interaction with, and in the case of my parents, respect for sort of everybody in town, no matter what their class or race. And it wasn't explicitly said, but it gave me a certain kind of growing up experience that was different from many other people.
And this was in the 50s?
This was in the 50s,
You were growing up, just to place it.
Late 40s and 50s, okay. Yes. I left New Mexico for college in 1962.
Okay. Did you feel that New Mexico really prepared you for going out into the world as you did? I mean, you really went into the world, not just into parts of the United States.
Right.
Eventually.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting because New Mexico didn't really prepare me. My parents really prepared me to have a kind of global perspective. We didn't come from New Mexico. My father came from North Carolina. My mother came from Massachusetts. So we traveled all over the United States to visit our cousins and relatives. And I think the part that New Mexico played is, in a sense, when I began to work internationally, more than many of my East Coast friends, I could really relate to people who grew up in smaller cities and in rural areas, in places that were, in a sense, not the center of the universe. And having grown up in a place that didn't pretend to be the way New York does, where I now live, sort of at the center of the universe, meant that I had a kind of understanding and way to interact with them about what their experience had been that was very different than many of the people they met from the big coastal cities. So it did prepare me in a way, but I wouldn't say that my preparation was typical of people in Artesia, because my parents didn't come from New Mexico, and they loved it in New Mexico, and they loved small-town life, but they also wanted us to know about the world.
Yes. You've said before that, and we've also heard from your sister on Women's Focus, that part of your family makeup, the makeup of your family, was sort of giving back and giving to community and being involved with the community.
Exactly. My parents were actually planning to go to China as missionaries, and that was interrupted by Pearl Harbor and World War II, and they never went there. But the kind of missionary spirit of giving back to the community, when he couldn't go to China, my father ended up first in rural North Carolina and then in Artesia, in part because he wanted to give to disadvantaged communities, and in part because he had very bad asthma, and so New Mexico was where he was the healthiest. So he really loved it, and he loved that kind of small-town community where you are able to be of service to everybody. So we did grow up with the notion that wherever you are, your meaning in life is to be a part of that community and to give back to people.
And so what made you decide that you wanted to go east to college?
Well, I think because my parents had come from the East Coast, so we traveled there a lot, and my parents had also gone to Duke University, where I went.
Oh, I see.
And I think that, you know, they took us to the campus, and I fell in love with it. None of my brothers or sisters went there. I was probably the one who I wanted to travel and go somewhere farther away from home, and that was the place I knew because they had gone there. So if it hadn't been the place they had gone, I might have gone somewhere else, but I was definitely wanting to go to the East Coast because my parents did come from the East Coast, and they did give me a sense of the richness of the intellectual life there. I think they picked me out. I was the third of four children, and I think they picked me out very early as the adventurous one who could be sent back to the East.
I was looking at the trailer for the movie that's going to be shown about your life, and it has pictures of some clips, I think, from your life, showing you back in the 60s. It seemed as though that was what was happening, and showing the kind of exuberance and excitement of the 60s, I thought.
Yes. No, I mean, I feel very lucky that I graduated from high school and went to Duke in 1962, just really as the civil rights movement was beginning to grow in North Carolina in particular, was at the center of that with the sit-ins and the freedom rides and so forth. So I felt that I got there and I was having two educations at the same time, one in the classroom and one outside from the civil rights movement. So it was a very exciting time. In fact, it really shaped my whole perception of my college education.
Well, let's talk about your founding the Center for Women's Global Leadership and how that came about.
Uh-huh. Well, I had worked in the U.S. domestic women's movement throughout the 70s and really felt very immersed in that. But by the end of the 70s, about the time that Reagan became president, I was feeling kind of burned out, as we call it now, and looking for some other way to do my feminist work. And I became very interested in what women were doing in other parts of the world. And I felt like that would somehow help me renew my own spirit of feminism or get some new ideas. And this was, again, I did this for several years before I got the opportunity to go to Rutgers University. I went there for 2 years as a visiting professor, and I loved it, and they liked me, and they had and still have the leading center on American women in politics at Rutgers, and so they said,
and that existed then?
That existed. The Center for American Women in Politics was formed long before I came.
Oh, okay.
The American Women in Politics Center. And they said, well, let's create a center on women and leadership or politics globally. So that really, because Rutgers had this other center, there was a framework for thinking about doing something on women globally, and I was able to create the Center for Women's Global Leadership at Rutgers, also because Rutgers has a very large and vibrant women's studies community.
Yes.
And that was in about 1990, and it took off from there.
And did you find that renewal by being able to go internationally instead of just concentrating in the United States?
I definitely did. I found that the women's movement, particularly in Latin America and parts of Asia in the 1980s, was very vibrant. And in a sense, the 80s was their period of our 70s in
yes.
the sense that they were really just booming and growing, and it immersed me in another way of looking at feminism and seeing how it was shaped by other cultural contexts. And during that time, I met my partner of the past 30 years, who's from Peru, so I was immersed in the Latin American movement in particular with her. And that gave me a real strong sense that feminism could grow beyond the boundaries of any one country and really be the basis for a global solidarity that we were able to build and develop in the 90s, in particular around the UN World Conferences on Women. So it definitely gave me that renewal to sort of recognize also, I think it's important that what was happening in the U.S. and has happened globally since then was a backlash against feminism precisely because of the importance of what we had tapped into in terms of the patriarchal attitudes of society, and that the backlash was really a sign of the importance of what we were doing.
And I may have said it to you before that a little before that time, when I was working for a while at Ms., one of the things that I was doing was monitoring the newspapers, the feminist newspapers and magazines that came from other countries, particularly mm-hmm. from Latin America. And there was a sense of excitement that as they were developing and expressing themselves in this, and the word was getting out to everyone.
Exactly.
It was an exciting time. We just talked about Beijing, the Beijing Women's Conference, the UN Women's Conference, because this is, I think, the 20th anniversary of it. And so the UN is doing a year of looking back at Beijing and where we've come since Beijing and sort of looking at the women's movement. And that's kind of exciting, although it's hard to believe that it's been 20 years since Beijing.
Exactly. 20 years, 20 years next year in 2015. But you're right, the UN has just launched the one-year lead-up to the 20th anniversary of the Beijing Conference. And we're all really hoping to use the 20th anniversary to remind people of what a breakthrough that conference represented in terms of the growth of feminism into a truly global movement that was able to impact policy internationally and in many, many countries around the world.
And actually, it had a much wider effect and it was much more successful, I think, in other countries rather than our own.
Well, I think I think what the Beijing conference represents is the fact that feminism was having an impact around the world. And there were women's movements in parts of the world who were kind of at the peak of that success. And so Beijing gave them a kind of global visibility. Within the U.S., I think our cycle was a little bit different. And also, quite frankly, we in the U.S. are not as good as other countries in using these international events to give us a boost. Maybe that has to do with being such a big country. Mm-hmm. So I think that partly it had a wider impact in some countries, but it was partly more integrated with what women were doing nationally in some places than it was here. There are many women in the U.S. who went to Beijing, and I think it actually did energize a lot of the women's movement in the U.S., but that was more at an individual level and less at an organizational level.
That's an interesting way to put it. I appreciate your analysis of that. I'm talking to Charlotte Bunch, and we're talking about her work at Rutgers University as she founded the Center for Women's Global Leadership, and also about her coming to New Mexico along with the film Passionate Politics, The Life and Work of Charlotte Bunch. Are you teaching still at Rutgers?
Yes, I am. I'm still a full-time faculty member at Rutgers. I gave up being the director of the Center for Women's Global Leadership about 4 years ago because I felt like it was time for new leadership of the Leadership Center. But I'm full-time faculty, and I teach gender and human rights, and I teach on women's leadership at Rutgers.
And we really appreciate your getting this conversation in between your travels. You just got back from Sri Lanka. Tell us about that.
Yes, I was at a very exciting for me meeting in Sri Lanka where several networks that primarily work in Muslim communities, the Women Living Under Muslim Laws Network, the Women's Empowerment Network that works in Indonesia and East Asia, and another group that's based primarily in Pakistan called Shirkat Gao, were evaluating and discussing their leadership training modules and looking at how to advance more women's leadership within their country. So there were women from Egypt, women from the Middle East, women from the Asia, particularly the South Asian continent, where most of the women who live in Muslim countries are, as well as women from Indonesia, from Hong Kong, from different parts of the Asian region. And I was part of that because while I was at the Center for Women's Global Leadership, we did a number of leadership trainings, including two with this network of women living under Muslim laws, which we had done in Istanbul and Lagos, Nigeria. So this was an opportunity to evaluate kind of the impact of that work and to help them think about how they want to shape it in the future.
And what was the impact? Because we hear so many pessimistic things about women under Muslim law.
Well, of course, there's a backlash and a very strong Muslim fundamentalist movement out there in the world today. But at the same time, we don't hear enough about these kinds of groups of women who have been, over the last 20, 25 years, organizing resistance to that movement and who have been working with women's groups on empowerment and leadership. So any one of these countries, you will have a strong core of feminists. They are under siege. It's not a very easy time for them right now. But again, part of that is the backlash against the kind of efforts that they have been making, often through the vehicle of the UN World Conferences or women, or just on their own.
So it shows
to defend women.
It shows some success.
It shows some success, and not success yet at the level of controlling the government, but certainly success at the level of women's groups. And it's really quite, for me, it's still energizing to hear the kind of work that they're doing, particularly the group from Pakistan, which has about 70 or 80 staff, and they do empowerment work with boys and girls, with girls as well as boys, I should say, at the local level in many countries in many parts of Pakistan where we know that the Taliban has been threatening and so forth. So they are really very engaged in trying to create for girls and boys a different model of what gender can be in their lives. So I think sometimes when we do hear about the terrible things that happen, we don't hear about the background. If you think of Malala, the famous Pakistani girl, you know, that her emergence is not an isolated individual. She's a part of something that's happening amongst girls. She's a particularly brave one, and she was a target, but she's not the only girl in Pakistan who's really fighting for her right to education. And a lot of that is the work of groups like the ones that I was meeting with, who've been doing this work at the grassroots in their countries for some time.
And was the conference, and are these groups funded by the UN?
This particular meeting, which was really more a workshop than a conference, was funded through a special grant from the Dutch government. So sometimes there are funding includes the UN, but in this particular case, there's several European governments who've been very involved in development and gender equality, the Swedish, the Dutch. In this case, it was funded through the Dutch government.
I'm talking to Charlotte Bunch, if you've just tuned in. Charlotte Bunch grew up in Artesia, New Mexico, but has been working on a worldwide stage on women's issues for many years. She will be in Albuquerque going to a meeting, and I assume speaking at a meeting of Church Women United. And
yes,
then because the movie of her life is going to be shown at the Chemo Theater, and we need to give you the dates. That's going to be June 4th at 5 p.m. will be the showing of Passionate Politics, the life and work of Charlotte Bunch. It must have felt a little strange to have a movie being made about your life.
Oh, it's very strange. I only agreed to it after a number of years when the woman who started the film said and made me realize, because I also teach, that these telling the stories of the feminist work of the past and the generations before today was crucial for young women to understand the history that came before them. And it was really she who convinced me that a film is a vehicle for particularly the next generations. But it was very difficult. It took many hours of conversation before I was comfortable revealing the level of personal detail that the filmmaker always wants to make the film interesting to other people. Oh. I should say that I will also be doing a question and answer after the film at the Chemo Theater. So if people come to that showing, I will be there to have discussion with them afterwards.
And again, the showing is going to be on June 4th at 5 p.m. and at the Chemo Theater. I don't think I said that earlier. And the name of the film is Passionate Politics, The Life and Work of Charlotte Bunch. Well, I've seen you when you've been back in New Mexico, and you've appeared before at various forums. And especially, I know that your mother and sister have been very proud to have you come back. How does it feel to sort of come back into the fold, as it were?
Well, I really love coming back to New Mexico. First of all, I love the light and the air and the space. You know, I live a active New York life, but it's really wonderful to see the sort of just the sky when I get to New Mexico. Always sort of grabs me, and I also like to find out how the ideas that I'm interested in are also perceived within the state. And I don't have as much to do with Artesia, but I've certainly been in Albuquerque regularly, where my sister lives, mm-hmm. And my mother used to live before she died. And so it does give me a sense of being connected to the place I grew up in, which is very important.
One of the things that we're working on here is trafficking. Have you been involved with any of the movements, the worldwide movements against that?
Yes, I have. I helped organize a workshop on trafficking women in 1983, and I think it's a major issue that has surfaced throughout the world, particularly in Asia, again, where the trafficking between Asia and Europe is intense. But today we see much of that in the United States, and I'm glad to see that people in this country are beginning to recognize both the trafficking within this country as well as the trafficking of women from other countries into the U.S.
I think it's shocking people to know that that happens now, and that it's been happening sort of under our eyes for a long time. And I think probably we'll even see more women come forth.
I think so, too. I think it's an issue that when you realize how much is happening and that you don't see it, it kind of shocks you about what you understand about what's going on in your own world.
When you speak to Church Women United, what are you going to be talking about?
Well, they are having their annual meeting, so I'm going to talk some about the intergenerational work that I've been trying to do, such as this meeting in Sri Lanka, which was about some of the younger women and older women doing leadership work together and understanding what we need from each other. And, of course, the kind of work that I was just describing globally, and the fact that I feel people don't hear enough in this country about what women are doing about the problems. Unfortunately,
yes.
Our media, when it covers the problems, doesn't very often tell you about the organizing and the women's movements that are addressing them. So I want to talk about what women are trying to do about it and how we in the U.S. can support them.
If our listeners are interested in getting involved with what's happening at Rutgers, with the Center for Women's Global Leadership at Rutgers, how can they find out? Is there a website?
There's a website. The center has a website, www.cwgl.rutgers.edu. And they can learn about the work of the center through that website. I also work very closely with two other global organizations that have a lot of information and access for people who are interested. One is the Global Fund for Women, based in San Francisco, that funds women's movement organizing around the world, and I think provides the money for not just women, but specifically the feminist organizing that's going on, and also something called AWID, the Association of Women's Rights and Development, which is www.awid.org, which is a leading network of information for women to know what other women are doing globally, and particularly has a hotline, what they call a hot wire for young feminists, what young feminists are doing. So I think that those are two other really valuable resources who really give people in this country, women who would like to link up globally, an opportunity to do so.
That sounds great. It sounds like you're not as discouraged about young feminists as some are.
I'm not really discouraged at all. I have to say that I teach, and that all my courses are feminist courses, and I have loads of students, particularly more so in the last 5 or 10 years than before this, who are women who are really trying to figure out how to be feminist activists and who are trying to figure out how to survive as such. So I think the conditions are different. I think every moment, every decade, we have a different set of problems that feminists face. And so I'm not expecting them to do exactly what we did or to show up in the same way, but I see them very engaged both globally and in the United States with trying to figure out how to make change. So if you look at some of the organizing going on in the U.S. around reproductive rights, the women, the young women who were involved in Texas, that were involved in North Carolina, and the challenges to reproductive rights, I think we just need to find more vehicles and opportunities. And there are lots of young women out there eager to express their activism.
That's great to hear. That's really great. Well, thank you very much for spending this time with us and for all the work that you do. We look forward to hearing more.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you, and I really look forward to being in New Mexico soon.
Thank you.
Right.
Bye.
Right. Bye.